The Senate Revenue Committee, we will start with a bill that we've heard once before, which is so we're going to do 2671 first, then we'll try to do the cargo bill, and then Representative Butler's bills. We'll do the last two, although we'll try to accommodate him at 1:45. If you're here to testify, and I'll open up a public hearing on 2671, there are amendments that are being offered to this bill, but if you're here to testify on the original bill, please feel free to identify yourself. If not, we'll bring up Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. The Dash 2 amendment that you have to Senate bill, or House bill, excuse me, 2671, is one that the chair and I have been working on regarding the state tax income statements for public utilities as defined in 757-005. Essentially, what this does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is to require that such public utilities, for the purposes of Oregon income tax, must file a non-consolidated income tax statement. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about public utilities and the earnings they have made when they are part of a consolidated holding company outside of Oregon. Mm-hmm. I will say, first of all, there's been some discussion about a lot of attention paid to PGE's $10 tax return of 02. This actually does not apply to that. They actually filed a non-consolidated statement in 02 for the $10 payment. Because of income that was able to be deferred to future years. It does reflect, however, those years after 1997 in which the tax that was collected through ratepayers for all utilities with the intention that it actually get inures benefit to those ratepayers and other citizens in the form of taxes were certainly received by the state at a far significant less level than was actually created by or the permission that was given by the Public Utility Commission. I know Mr. Hemingway is here to discuss that and how they collect state taxes through the rate-making process. We discussed a number of ways, Mr. Chair, and I know you have in previous testimony as you've been working on this issue, is how this might be accomplished. And I think I'd just like to address a couple of major points, and people will do that in testimony. You know, why are we doing public utilities? Why don't you do all businesses? Well, these are a totally different animal than other businesses. The public utilities have a rate of return that is set by the Public Utility Commission on their investment, and part of that is a rate enactment by the Public Utility Commission that allows to collect from ratepayers an estimated state tax liability. When that is collected by ratepayers but then not returned to ratepayers through the state coffers, then there certainly is an injustice that is created, either by the fact that the ratepayer shouldn't be paying it, it should return to ratepayers in one form or another. By requiring states to file a non-consolidated tax form, this is one way to get at that. Now, we discussed a number of approaches, both with attorneys from the folks from the Public Utilities Commission and Legislative Council. This seemed to be the easiest way to get there. There are other ways, and I think Mr. Hemingway will talk about some of those, in which the Public Utility Commission could also do this in the rate-making process. This might be the simplest way, however, to do that. Now, when you have a non-consolidated state tax return, that doesn't necessarily mean that the state's going to collect a lot of money. Obviously, if there's a loss, it's going to be reflected in that return. There also is going to be sure, though, and on a consistent basis, year in and year out, those activities created within the state of Oregon and collected by state of Oregon ratepayers will, in fact, inure to the benefit of the state based on the profitability of that utility. I think this is a way to get at that issue in a fair and equitable way. I think it also gives assurance to ratepayers that when they pay state taxes, that they'll be returned. And the final thing I'll just say, just as a comment, because I want to make this clear, is that we have a great history of well-run utilities in the state of Oregon. In fact, PGE, prior to the sale of it to Enron, has been a great, great local company, and I think it's going to be a great local company again. I think the people who work there, this has nothing to do with Enron. It has nothing to do with that. I think the great folks who serve us at PGE are more disheartened than the rest of the state, because they've taken a greater financial hit in many cases because of the fraud that was taken about with Enron. They're a great company with a great history, and I think that this will try to help prevent future activities that we've seen in the past from any utility from out-of-state holding companies. And I think Mr. Hemingway will also testify to the fact that the PUC has been wrestling with ways in which to put a fence around the activities of local utilities, and they've done that in other areas. This is another fence around the operations of utilities in the state of Oregon. And I would look forward to the discussion to see if this is the best way to go. I think it is probably the most simplest way to go, but I think it would be in the best interest of Oregonians and ratepayers to make sure that when taxes are paid and collected, that they actually do inure to the benefit of the state.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Metzger?
I sure do.
Senator Farrell.
Thank you. My read of the bill indicates it probably only applies to two utilities in the state. PG&E and Northwest Natural Gas.
Three.
Which is the other, please?
Scottish Power.
Mm-hmm. It's my estimation that all of those companies, in doing acquisitions, look at an integration of their business plan, and they look at the assets, the depreciation schedules, the income stream, the deferred maintenance, the accruals, that they basically do a pretty thorough analysis of how that business is going to fit into a more global picture for that corporation or that company or that entity, that business entity. And I just wondered if the disintegration of this tax treatment or the deconstruction of this tax treatment is going to affect how potential purchasers would look at acquisition of PG&E.
Yeah.
Or any of the other utilities that have to be put into a larger continuum to be able to work financially for the purchaser. How does your bill affect those?
Well, I think that's an unknown question, Senator, as to whether it would have a positive, negative impact on other companies outside of Oregon investing in Oregon utilities. I think, and I also, and I think that would be a good question to some of the experts too, to see if they have, or the Public Utility Commission, is whether they see that will have an impact. Because I think that really is a $64,000 question as to whether it would necessarily be a negative or positive impact on them. I think there's a broader question, and that would be too, what is it if the state wanted to encourage out-of-state ownership or local ownership as well? I mean, I think you could also ask that question as well.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I see that is an irrelevancy to the tax treatment of this issue. It's going to be a fully integrated vertical and horizontal energy company, or it's going to be a homegrown mom-and-pop enterprise. But in any case, the disaggregation of the tax treatments probably favors a local purchaser. Probably almost guarantees that you'd try to find a local purchaser. And as far as I know, there may only be one potential local purchaser in the state of Oregon. So I guess if this was a poison pill to put out there to prevent other utilities that could be operators that have integrated systems from purchasing, maybe that's what the intention here is to create that poison pill.
No. Well, Senator, that is not actually the intention at all, but I think that's a good discussion point to have as to whether or not having the the funds that are collected for state tax through the Oregon's rate of return regulation is something that should be guaranteed to go to ratepayers. I mean, and I think you'll hear in another testimony on this bill that there are other ways you can approach that, and then you could also ask the same question if the Public Utility Commission were to change the way in which they collected fees from ratepayers for taxes, whether they wanted to do that retrospectively rather than prospectively based on what they paid the previous years. I mean, that's something else the PUC has looked at and could possibly do. And you could also ask yourself as to whether that is an investment decision by other companies or not. But I really think that's an unclear question as to whether that it does, in fact, by itself make a difference in terms of what who might want to invest in, say, any utility in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the concern I have is simply that to make a change in tax treatment at a time when this entity is being marketed actively and companies soliciting new operators to essentially keep it from going down the sinkhole of the Enron meltdown, to me is at least questionable. The understanding that I have of the way these businesses have to be marketed, although it's relatively limited, the experience I can draw on is the wind power developments that we've seen in the Mid-Columbia, and those things simply have to be integrated into a larger business model, and the tax treatment is critical to penciling these things out or not, and change the tax treatment now, I think, on the eve of the request for proposals being answered is perhaps something that we ought to look at very carefully in terms of public policy. And, you know, I'm fully in sympathy and support with the idea that Oregon corporations ought to pay their fair share of taxes. And I think if you look at the whole picture on PGE, you see there's a pattern of that with some carryover and different amounts being paid in different years, just like any other taxpayer does. But I'm certainly not interested in seeing anybody operate a business as large as this and not pay their full share of taxes. But I'm also very aware that if outside purchasers or other operators of integrated energy systems take a look at this and see that they're going to not be able to integrate the operations of this potential into their overall picture and look at the bigger picture for tax treatment, this is a far less attractive target for acquisition. And I'm worried about that at this point in time when we want to see an operator, a good operator with a track record, an integrated system operator come in and take over this facility or watch it be pieced and parted out and sold off in proceedings against the parent company. I'm really worried about the tack we're taking on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. And I just had one. You did talk to the sponsors of the bill about the amendments.
I believe that the sponsor of the bill, yes. Senator Harper.
Thank you. Cindy, I know you just got the amendments. I'm not sure if you want to testify today. The bill's not moving. There were several points brought up that you might wish to clarify, but you can. It's up to you if PG wants to. Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else in the back that wishes to get up? And no. Do you want to come up? If you're going to speak, you have to. And then Mr. Hemingway will get to you and the customers following Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Quickly reading the amendments, which I've just had an opportunity to look at, appears that it would apply to our company. I don't know that it has any real impact on us, but I would like an opportunity to take it back and talk through both the immediate impact and any long-term impacts it might have on us. Thank you.
You certainly will have plenty of time before this amendment is back.
Thank you.
For the committee. Mr. Hemingway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Roy Hemingway, Chair of the Public Utility Commission. I'm not able to take a position on this bill today because the Public Utility Commission is right now made up of two people, and we must consult with one another in order to be able to take a position on a bill, and we have a meeting, and of course we must do that in public. And so we have a noticed meeting tomorrow where we may be able to take this up and talk about it together. In addition, I'd be very loath to take a position on the specific language of this bill because it is a tax bill. And one thing I know from having practiced law for a relatively short time is that if you aren't a tax lawyer, you probably have trouble understanding all the ramifications of any particular change in tax law. And so I would want to hear from the tax experts on your committee and from the Department of Revenue before I would were to say that this bill should merit our endorsement or not. I do want to talk, though, about utility taxes and the problems that they have presented for us. Let me first take the example of a utility that doesn't have a holding company over it. It's simply a company on its own. And in that case, when we have a rate case, we estimate the amount of taxes that that company will owe, and then we include those taxes in rates. And those rates are then in effect as long as the company doesn't over-earn or under-earn its allowed rate of return. If it over-earns, we can open up the record and start a new rate case. If they under-earn, they're likely to come into us and ask for a rate increase. Their actual taxes may be very different from what was estimated in the rates. Just as with any other expense, may be very different. But as long as they're not over-earning or under-earning with respect to their allowed rate of return, we do not go in and change rates just because one expense has changed. That is the way utilities are regulated throughout the country with respect to taxes. Now let's take the more complicated example of a utility that's owned by a holding company. And we have a number of them in Oregon. In fact, I think nearly all of our major energy utilities are owned by holding companies. And I don't know whether our small water utilities, any of them are owned by holding companies. So if you proceed with this bill, you might want to make it just energy public utilities and not water utilities, because our largest water utility, I think, serves 6,000 customers. It's not a particularly big issue. When we deal with a utility that's owned by a holding company and we have a rate case, we treat that company as if it were a standalone company. We do not go in and try to estimate Enron's rate of return or Scottish Power's rate of return, for instance. We look at PGE's rate of return and what Pacific Corp's cost of capital might be. We then do the same thing. We estimate the taxes as if it were a standalone company, just as we had in the first example. Then the utility pays the amount that it then calculates its taxes, and then it pays that amount to the holding company. Now, the holding company itself may or may not have significant tax liability in Oregon or to the federal government. In the case of it having significant tax liability, it will pay those taxes. It may actually end up paying more taxes in Oregon than were collected in rates. It may end up, as in the case with Enron, paying considerably less taxes in Oregon than were collected, estimated in rates. And that's the problem that we face, is that customers have a hard time understanding why they should be paying rates that include taxes that may not come back to the state of Oregon. And our explanation is that, well, in some years it may well be that the opposite happens, that more is collected or less is collected in taxes than we actually get from the consolidated company in taxes. But in a situation like Enron, where we've had years and years and years of the parent company paying little or no taxes in Oregon, this is a difficult thing to explain. Now, we have just started to grapple with this issue. And I can, off the top of my head, say that I can conceive of some regulatory solutions for dealing with this that may not require legislation, or perhaps they might. And that one would be to keep track of taxes separately and not to worry about and not to just let them go as the company earns or under-earns its rate of return from one year to the next, but to actually keep track of them and only pass on to the allow utility to charge and rate the actual taxes that the company pays.
So Brian, that you would track the state. I mean, obviously you couldn't, I don't think you could do the federal for the holding company, so you would just track the state.
Well, that's what one of the questions I would need to ask the lawyers is if the holding company had no tax liability, could we then say to the federal government, could we then say that the subsidiary utility should not have to pay anything to the parent? Now, that is a question of law that I can't answer right now. And it may well have an effect upon utility accounting in a way that I don't fully understand either. So I would want to talk that over with our experts as to whether we could put into place something like that. Again, I can't say whether this bill is the right solution or not the right solution. I can say that we do have a problem, particularly with the fact that the public has trouble understanding that taxes are included in their rates, but sometimes the utility that actually that they pay those taxes to sometimes doesn't pay taxes, and sometimes the holding company of the utility doesn't pay any taxes despite the fact that taxes are included in rates. There have been two editorials in the Oregonian criticizing us on this question, even though we do things exactly the way every other state does, and is that we do it in a standard way of utility accounting. But it is a problem, and I would like to explore mechanisms for addressing it. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Hemingway. Questions? No, you're busy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Customers, would you like to come and address this issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling, representing the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. First off, we would like to thank Senator Metzger for bringing forward this amendment and raising the discussion topic. Like previous speakers, we haven't had enough time to actually analyze the particular amendment, and so are not prepared today to comment directly upon it. But would like to reiterate, I think, the point that Senator Metzger made, that the issue of customers paying rates that include amounts that are assumed to be paid to state and federal authorities is a subject of concern to us on really two levels. One, rates are high. I mean, I think no one in this building has not heard the customers' concerns expressed about the high rates that many of our companies are facing and that represent an impediment for new investment, hiring people that would help our economy move forward. We appreciate how we got here, but we also are looking for ways to try to get out of this problem. So if these dollars are not going to be paid in taxes, we would hope that we would not have to pay as high rates as a result of that. Second of all, like others, we are concerned that, in fact, we do need additional revenue, both at the state level and elsewhere, and that, in fact, these are taxes that we pay as part of our rates. My customer clients are people that pay more than $1 million a month in electricity bills. A well-known company whose name I won't mention but is in Washington County spends $40 million a year for electricity. So the amount of taxes that we're talking about that are built into those rates are not without some consequence. So it is an issue that we care about. We appreciate, again, the fact that this discussion is on the table. I think Chairman Hemingway has raised another interesting option on maybe how to get at this, and we would encourage the committee to continue to look into the subject. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris Matt.
Chairman Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm representing the Citizens Utility Board, CUB. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. Much like my colleague from the industrial customers, haven't had much of a chance to look at the amendment. It is an intriguing concept and a discussion we'd very much like to be a part of. The one thing that we could say just from a rate perspective is that this amendment doesn't harm ratepayers. This is, as Chairman Hemingway outlined, this is the way, in sort of a standalone basis, that rates are set. And so that's a good start in our book. But in terms of how, you know, whether it's the right revenue policy and that sort of thing, or if this is the right approach, we're certainly very willing to take part in that discussion and explore the issue, because as has been talked about before, it is a key issue on the minds of many many ratepayers, simply because of all the media that has been raised around these issues. And so on behalf of the residential ratepayers, if the committee chooses to move forward on it, or if there's forums at the PUC, we'll definitely be there and taking a part in those discussions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else on the 8th, please come on up. And anyone else that would like to speak on the dash A2s, just House Bill 2671.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. We would just like to go on record as having some concerns about the amendment. I understand the issue and I understand the intent. I'm not sure that this really gets to what the senator is hoping to achieve. As a general rule, states that use separate reporting for corporations experience more shifting of income and avoidance of tax, if you will, by corporations than using consolidated filing. So that's a general statement. It's not specific to...
Do you know, Deborah, would that apply in terms of a regulated utility, or any inkling on that, how that might...
Mr. Chairman, I think Chairman Hemingway pointed out really the problem, which is a disconnect between regulatory income and taxable income for these corporations. As he explained, the regulatory income is used to determine the tax rate. It's an estimate of what their tax liability would be. It may be totally unrelated to what their actual tax liability is when they file the return with us. And it seems that an approach that looks more toward truing up those things, truing up the estimate of tax with the actual tax, is a good approach. I'm not sure that separate reporting, even for a regulated company, can avoid the pitfall of a corporation using tax planning. For example, you could have a regulated corporation in Oregon that sets up an affiliate in another state, and then through intercompany transactions, they can shift income out and move expenses in and reduce their actual tax liability. Or the regulatory income, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in it, obviously. Might not be impacted. So we're more than happy to work with Senator Metzger and the PUC to come up with whatever they think might work.
Sure. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you. You got off without any questions. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2671. Folks just got those amendments, so if they could get to Senator Metzger or myself with any feedback they would have, that will help guide us as we move forward. Oh. open a public hearing on House Bill 2625. How was your weekend, Mazin?
It was great.
Good. What was this bill to?
This bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, extends or reactivates, to be more precise in using the words, the property tax exemption for the cargo containers, since the sunset date have obviously gotten away with sunsetting. In July 1st, 2002, this extends it back to the year 2010. The cargo containers have gone through several iteration of discussions in the past since 1979, and there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision exempting the containers used for international trade from the taxation. However, the AG in Oregon determined that those containers that are used in within the trade here in Oregon and within the borders are personal property and should be taxed accordingly. Thus, this law that extends an exemption from property taxation, and by extending this law, there is about what we're thinking about $40 million of value. Most of that is used for containers with international trade. However, some of it works within the negative impact. Would be about $1 million, but that's a continuation of what we've got.
Hard to gauge, too. Ms. Joan Buck, Mr. Rob Douglas, and Mr. Keith Levitt. Ms. Joan Buck, Mr. Robert Douglas, and Mr. Keith Levitt. We might have technical questions on this, Joan, and we know you would be the one for any highly technical questions we might have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association and the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. Thank you for hearing this bill. This, as committee staff indicated, would continue the property tax exemption for cargo containers. This is important. They have never been taxed in Oregon, and they are not taxed in the neighboring jurisdictions. So those shipping lines are looking for a place to drop these containers. Oregon would be at a disadvantage, we believe, if they were taxed here in Oregon. Bill passed the House. I think it had one no vote on the floor, and we urge your passage today.
Rob, do you know, have these ever been taxed? I think when I talked to Keith, it would be just very difficult, it seems, to actually, even if you wanted to try to put a mechanism in place to tax the cargo. Do you know if this is...
Mr. Chairman, they've not been taxed in Oregon, and you'd have all sorts of apportionment problems, how long they were actually in the state, what was the value of that particular container, what was the path of commerce that container took, was it international, was it all domestic. It could be an administrative nightmare, I would think.
Senator Ringo.
You said they're not taxed in our neighboring states. Are they taxed anywhere in the country?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, on the House side, we had a representative from K-Line, which is one of the largest shippers, and they do not pay this tax anyplace. So if they had to pay it in Oregon, it would be the only jurisdiction they'd have to pay it in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Keith Levitt with Port of Portland, and we obviously support this bill for all the reasons already articulated. Container shipping is an important component of international trade for the state, impacting some 900 to 1,000 businesses throughout Oregon and almost every county. And our ability to compete as a container terminal, as many of you know, we're
We're not a big, huge player in the world of containers, and our ability to compete is always on how we can control costs. And this is a key component of that, and we would ask you to support this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Bach, Senator Starr.
Question. This extends the sunset from 02 to 2010. Why do we need a sunset at all? Why do we need to revisit this, you know, 7 years from now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, actually, we were surprised at the draft as well when we submitted it. I believe it was through Representative Shetterly's office. We asked that the sunset be removed, but the draft came back in this fashion based upon previous legislation, and we're going to try and set the alarm clock for 2010 so that we wake up and act in a prompt manner.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I've got my Palm Pilot in 09. I need to make sure that I come to the legislature and ask for an extension on that sunset.
Mr. Chair.
Mazin.
Exemptions that are given by the state that affect property that resides in the counties. If the state gives that exemption and it impacts counties, it need to do a compensation for the counties accordingly. So these are things that are excluded if they have the sunset into built in.
Oh. Then we would have to gauge how much to recompensate.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
I think committee staff brings up an important point. The even though the Port of Portland might not be the greatest container shipper on the West Coast, what you do if you made these things taxable is cause a flooring cost to be developed and transferred to a bunch of people. And you know, we've gone through different time in Oregon where there's been boxcar container shortages, which just devastated manufacturing in the state of Oregon. And, you know, just the idea that there would be a disincentive for leaving this shipping material available in the state and scattered all over the 36 counties at various manufacturing sites would really be foolish, in my opinion. So I think this almost comes under the category of no-brainer, as one of my colleagues described this to me earlier today. So if the chairman doesn't think it precipitous to move into work session, that might be the easiest mechanism for dealing with this good piece of legislation.
I just don't want to miss Joan's testimony. Do we have any other further questions or comments?
Perhaps Ms. Buck could nod vigorously for the record.
You know. Anything else, Ms. Buck, we should know before we push this thing onto the floor?
I agree with the members of the
committee. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2625 and work session.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farrelly has moved House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Farrelly?
I would be honored, Mr. Chairman.
This no-brainer.
I'm good at those.
Okay, I told Tom, our Representative Butler, we would get to him at 1:45, and we're about a half a minute early. Should let him know.
Yes.
3072.
On which one?
3072.
No, 3072 is...
Hold on,
yeah.
What are you doing this on?
2298, though.
Okay.
So you want to do 2298.
Okay.
I think
that's
right.
Yes, it is. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2298. And Mr. Malik, what's this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2298 changes or modifies requirements for the business firms in what known as a small city business development. This is one of the tenets of the development or economic development in the state. This is geared more towards small cities with small businesses. This allows these businesses to have income tax exemptions or credits in that sense. This bill changes the definitions of which cities qualify, and also lowers down the eligible employees, number of eligible employees from 10 employees to 5. There are about 5 incidents where this law will intersect with the non-urban enterprise zone. In those 5 incidents, you would have a combination of what would be the small city and the enterprise zone, which means both exemptions for income tax and property taxes where it is applicable. this will expand again from about 12 cities as law exists today of what is eligible to about 35 cities and few more industrial zones. The revenue impacts for both property tax that we've talked about with the interlocking or intersecting with the long term and the small city is about something small in the tune of $50,000 a biennium. Remember, those are small businesses in small cities, and therefore the impact and the utility of them are not large.
Mathen, do you know offhand a good example of this? I know it's been brief in its inception, but a small, and Representative Butler may be able to speak to this, but a good example of small businesses taking advantage of this.
We actually have a list of these businesses, not many. Fortunately, this is not a heavily utilized incentive. If I could find it, I'll.
Well, I'll call Representative Butler. He will. Please come up.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. Your question, Madison, was have the businesses taken advantage of this particular legislation, the Small Community Investment Program? And there have not. There have not been since its inception in 2002. It began on January 1st, 2002. And these are some of the corrections that are being brought before you today. You'll recognize, Chair Deckert, the concept of tax-free to or tax exemptions for new-to-Oregon business. That's a concept which we have tried to use in rural Oregon to bring folks into Fossil and Monument and other megapolises such as that, but recognize that these are communities that experience two phenomena that keep them on the bottom of the pile. Number one, super high unemployment for long periods of time, and then the very low per capita income. And when those two concentric circles join together in that location, you got double whammy. There's lots of unemployment with lots of low wage. And what the bill does, what the amendments to this bill, to this particular section of the law does, is it allows those communities to, number one, to remain in the qualifying category, particularly with regard to the unemployment over a longer period of time, so that the OECD can go out and bring the folks who want to move to Oregon with their businesses to those communities and hold that out as a carrot to try and get them to attract to the small communities in those distressed communities. Second thing it does is it reduces the number of jobs, family wage jobs, that are required to bring those businesses to rural Oregon from 10 jobs down to 5 jobs. And then one other thing that it does that I felt was a good idea at the time, at the time the bill, when it passed in the 2001 session, basically said you have to be inside of a city limit because we want you to use the sewer and water and infrastructure within that city limit. Then we found out that there were folks that wanted to come to Lake County and Lakeview, and that their industrial park is adjacent to the city limits, but it's not in the city limit. And it has all the sewer and water and everything else in it, but they couldn't use it. And then we also found that as we began discussing this, that some of the ports and communities that had ports that qualified with high unemployment and low per capita wages, that ports were not within city limits. So the port classification has been added to the cities. So, and again, the reason was that we did not want these businesses to be attracted to rural Oregon, to locations where they wouldn't have water and sewer and the infrastructure. And now what we're doing is we're basically saying, wait a minute, if you'll come to a community, and even though it's outside the city limit but still in the growth area where we've got our industrial plant or within our port, that if you're going to hook up to the water and sewer and use our infrastructure, then you can still come and bring your businesses to Oregon. Again, this is an attempt to try and bring new-to-Oregon business, and they have to pay a fee to the OECD and do basically what your local regional development officer is already hired to do, and that is to go ahead and then bring that business to the local city leaders, the local county leaders, and is willing to authorize and sign off on that business him or herself as the regional development officer, that that is a new to Oregon business, and that those folks, after they pay their qualification fee, then annually they can have an exemption from the income that's earned by that business, the net income that's earned by the business after they've paid all of their expenses and labor and wages and so forth. Then the net income after that is tax exempt from income. Now they have to make an investment in property, plant, and equipment within the community. They have to, and it doesn't matter whether they're in an enterprise zone, those kinds of things. If they're in a small community that has an enterprise zone, so much the better for them if they make all of those qualifications. But again, it requires the city and the county, as well as the regional development officer, to sign up. And then annually, as the regional development officer confirms that they have paid their employees the wage that they're prescribed to have paid, needed to have paid them, and that they continue to qualify in all other respects, then they would have an opportunity to charge them for the continued inspections of their operation, inspections of their payroll report that shows that they have provided that. Now, the other thing it does is that it also takes the size of a community from 10,000, communities under 10,000 to communities under 15,000, because we're aware that in small rural communities, both in coastal, southern, and eastern Oregon, there are some communities that have, or there are some counties that have cities that are greater than 10,000 people that really are on the cusp of having, well, they do have high, very high unemployment and very low per capita wages.
Thank you. Senator Hannon.
Representative Butler, did you discuss this with the Department of Revenue on the confidentiality when you worked the bill in the House in the Revenue Committee?
With regard to House Bill 3072?
Yeah.
Yes, we have, Senator, and that's... did you want me to discuss that now?
Oh, are we on the... I wanted to ask a question on this, Mr. Chairman, but I'll wait.
Okay, we're gonna go right to that.
Okay, we're gonna go right to that. Okay,
time wisely, so we'll finish with this and we'll move right there.
Okay.
Anything further,
Senator Deckard, members of the committee? I just this is an idea which we're trying to flesh out to encourage folks. I've tried to use a test of who would come to Eastern Oregon, who would come to rural Oregon, who would come to southern Oregon under these kinds of things. I think that we've just, as a result of the fact that Lakeview is a community with high unemployment and low per capita wages, I think we just got right very, very close to having about a 30-job business that was lined up to go into the industrial park in Lake County in Lakeview early in 2002. And then when we found out that they were outside the city limits, they really couldn't justify moving a business from California to Oregon, a manufacturing business, in the old lumber mill portion of town. But I have every belief that with the modifications and amendments to the Small Communities Investment Act, that we will in fact encourage folks to move to rural Oregon, and some of these communities, you can see the list, some of them they may be bringing foundries. Again, if they compete unfairly, if the city council or the county commission believe that they're competing unfairly with an existing business, they just don't sign off. Mm-hmm. It still allows them to have control over the folks that arrive in town if they feel like it would unfairly compete with the folks that are there. And we're trying to discourage anyone to come to town and set up side by side with someone else and say, well, you're new to town, and therefore you qualify for this income tax exemption. Then I also need to recognize that anyone that's new to town, when we start talking about exemptions from income, those folks that are moving new businesses to town recognize for the first 5 to 8 years, many of them because of depreciation and startup costs and so forth, they're really not profitable, not enormously profitable. And so when they bring these businesses new to Oregon and we're saying we give them an income tax exemption on a net income after they've paid out five or more family wage jobs, usually we're not talking about the foregoing any large amount of revenue. The revenue is minuscule, as we've seen in the past, for startup businesses. So it gives us an excellent opportunity to bring new blood to small distressed communities in Oregon.
Thank you. Do you worry at all, and I guess I always have to ask myself the same question, that perhaps we might be putting too many programs, and I guess OEDD might be able to speak to this also, too many programs into place. I mean, we have enterprise zones. We have a number of incentive-based programs. We added e-commerce enterprise zones. I noticed you taking off your hat, so that may indicate
closer.
If we pass this.
We're getting closer, Mr. Chair.
This is a
bill which would benefit small rural counties that I have the benefit with co-chair and Senator Ferrioli to assist in representing. And I believe that once this bill actually does get passed, that we will in fact see new to Oregon employment come in. So the concern that you had was, Mr. Chair, was are we scattering too many programs? This offers an additional incentive, but it focuses it down to the very most rural communities that really don't have an opportunity to probably ever come in on any kind of a enterprise zone, or that don't have the ability to attract any larger industry, and we're not really attempting to attract large industry, because a small community, pick out a Jordan Valley where we used to have a mining operation on the Idaho side, which has left us with 100 or more vacant jobs there in that particular community. We'd love to have someone to come to town and put together, and you realize that five full-time required jobs is really the equivalent of probably 7 jobs. And so we're anxious to have those folks come to town and set up, and this would give them an opportunity. But the OECD and our regional development officers at first were very, very interested, and particularly in the rural portions of Oregon on the coast, southern Oregon, southeastern and eastern Oregon. I had a number of calls beginning in late 2001 and early 2002. How do we go about this? And mostly from the regional development officers, asking if it was my idea that this would qualify or that. That's when we found out that the ports and those areas of industrial areas around cities that are serviced by the utilities and are within the urban growth boundaries may be a good attraction for these companies, but the parameters that we had around the bill were just very restrictive and intentionally so. Mm-hmm. But we believe that the RDOs will come back with the prospects in hand and be able to establish some of these businesses in rural Oregon.
Senator Starr.
I appreciate very much this bill, and I appreciate the work that you've put into them, bringing them to us, and the issues that are faced in rural Oregon. I'm looking at this, and I look at my county, and I've got a significant portion of Washington County that's rural with small towns that I wonder, what's in it for them to a certain extent. Clearly, the county that those small towns in are in isn't faced with the kinds of unemployment that we see in eastern and maybe southern Oregon, and yet those small towns, probably the unemployment rate within those small rural towns in Washington County could be significantly higher than the county as a whole. I guess just a comment on that, as a legislator from you know, the rural part of the state, speaking to a legislator from a more urban part of the state.
Chair Deckard, Senator Starr, I appreciate the fact that there are, and that's one of the uniqueness that we have in our diversity of our economies, is that there are, in fact, some counties that are doing very, very well, but they have some small communities that aren't doing as well. And fortunately, many of those areas are within commuting distance of where employment can be sought. That's one of the disadvantages, particularly when you're looking at county-wide unemployment. When we talk about county-wide unemployment, we're talking about a county. We're talking about counties with 10,000 square miles, 6.5 million square acres out there that people can't commute from one job to another, and that's what keeps the unemployment in double digits. All four of the counties that I represent, unfortunately, have double digit unemployment, and none more so than Grant County, Senator Ferrioli's home base, and I'm very, very concerned about that. But by the same token, if I can get just one or two businesses to move to Canyon City or to John Day or to Monument or to Fossil, if I can just get a smattering of new blood invested in those communities, with folks bringing in property, plant, equipment, and jobs to those communities, that makes a great deal of difference. And again, that's why my hat starts to wiggle, and when we start talking about jobs for small communities, because remember, six jobs in Harney County in Burns, Oregon, is the same as having 870 new jobs in one business in Beaverton or in Portland. And if you could land 870 new jobs in one business, I mean, you'd get some pretty good press out of it. And so I'm just after six jobs, and I don't need any press. I just need the jobs.
Thanks. I'm going to open a public hearing on your other bill so that we use your time efficiently. Close the public hearing on 2298. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3072. Mr. Warner.
Sir, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3072 actually did not go through the House Revenue Committee. It went through the General Government Committee. And what that bill does is it allows state agencies or the board or commission that issue occupational licenses as a condition of issuance of or renewal of that license to require the licensee to attest to compliance with personal income tax laws of the state. It refers specifically to ORS 305.265 or 3.14.400, in which an individual would falsely prepare and file with the intent to evade a tax. If someone has been convicted of that, then they're no longer eligible for renewal or issuance of a license. It allows the Department of Revenue to enter into agreements with state agencies to enforce and to ensure that when the agency has chosen to do so, that they haven't violated those statutes, and it allows the department to adopt rules for tax compliance.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60. The goal of this bill is to assist those state agencies who issue those privileged licenses, which agencies, boards, or commissions may wish to have some independent attestation as to the income tax compliances in relationship to those licenses, and then those agencies then may seek the limited information relative to individuals and company compliance with regard to Oregon's filing requirements. This has been an issue that and it's not a wildly popular issue, I'll admit that, that basically allows the Department of Revenue to cooperate with those agencies in disclosing limited information to assist the administration in compliance with tax filing as well as licensure in the state of Oregon. I've had a couple of groups, and there are folks within the House of Representatives themselves that didn't care for the idea of having agencies become Big Brother and basically attest to whether or not folks are filing their tax returns. But if you read the scope of the bill, the scope of the bill is very narrow right now, and I understand that perhaps the Department of Revenue would like to go ahead and offer some amendments to perhaps amplify the scope of the information that can be provided and under what circumstances. Under this program right now, for the past 4 years, I've been attempting to ask the Department of Revenue if it is cooperating with those folks, with the balance of government, those folks who are issuing these licenses, and basically they've told me in the past that they really don't have the authority to receive intercommunication back and forth. After some prompting in this particular session, however, the department was able to go out to the Construction Contractors Board, which is an older board that has a significant licensing database, and they've taken that database, which is all in computerized format, and have done the first comparison. Recognize this is the first time in the history of the state of Oregon that what we've been able to do is we've been able to say are folks with licenses, the privileged licenses, that they are buying on a regular basis, annual or biannual basis, are they filing tax returns? And so we got a first run from the Department of the Construction Contractors License, and I can give you some of the statistics. I don't want to bore you with all the statistics, but the first run indicated that 15% of the 22,000 licenses, or nearly 22,000 licenses with Oregon addresses, 15% were not filing income tax returns. So what you've got is you've got a group of people who are willing to pay hundreds of dollars for a license on a biannual basis, a full construction contractor's license, but they're not filing a tax return. Now, that doesn't mean that they're in willful failure to file. It doesn't mean anything other than at this particular point, maybe their Social Security numbers are wrong. But the more a more concerning figure might be the fact that folks with non-Oregon addresses, when they're applying for their out-of-state contractor who applies annually for an Oregon license, a third of those folks are not filing Oregon income tax returns. In my professional experience and background, that's a pretty good indication that what they're doing is they're probably filing in their home state, perhaps in Nevada, perhaps in Idaho, perhaps in Washington, maybe in Washington, Nevada, where there are no income taxes. They're filing in their home state and avoiding filing in the state of Oregon when they ought to be filing in the state of Oregon for any construction contractors' jobs for which they're applying for a license in Oregon. And what this does is this just makes certain that we have some degree of compliance with regard to those folks who are seeking the licensure. And again, I've had folks from the trucking industry who are very concerned about the fact that the truck licenses would be pulled, or the drivers, the special driver's licenses may be pulled. I've had folks from some of the professional licensing boards that say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to work out, or a spouse didn't file a tax return, and that leaves us in a quandary. It really has nothing to do with that level as much as it has to do with the fact that if licensing boards want an attestation, an independent attestation, that they would be able to get it from the Department of Revenue, and vice versa, that the Department of Revenue would have an ability to make certain that those folks that should be filing in Oregon are in fact filing in Oregon.
Representative Butler, I've been sitting here reading all this information on this, and I don't know. I just find it as a classic example of something that only a CPA could think of, because it has absolutely nothing to do with what licenses are for. Licenses first are supposedly for consumer protections. You mentioned the Consumer Construction Board or the Construction Contractors Board. It's been as phony as a $3 bill from the day it was created. It has absolutely nothing to do with consumer protection. Now you're trying to turn it into a tax collection agency for the state of Oregon. Personally, I think that this is an example of government wasting time. I don't know how much it costs to print this bill and how much time has been spent on generating testimony and input in the House, but this is a classic example of the state going to hell in a handbasket, and we're worried about a licensure board being a tax collecting agency for the state of Oregon. Now, this is maybe something that I need to be enlightened to, but I just heard your explanation. I've been reading all this documentation that is accompanying the bill, and I find very little to support what your position is based upon. Now, is there something else I'm missing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, if you're not concerned about the folks that are practicing law or practicing medicine or those kinds of things being diligent and meeting their state responsibilities, if you're not concerned about the revenue of the state of Oregon, and that's what this is in part, is it makes certain that when we're issuing a privileged license that we do in fact have those folks complying with the Oregon income tax provisions, which are strictly voluntary. And at that particular point, if you're going to come forward and accept a voluntary or accept a privileged license and apply for a privileged license, should you be complying with the voluntary requirements of the tax code? And my answer to that is yes.
Well, first of all, you keep referring to it as a privileged license. I can tell you as an insurance agent, it's not a privilege to be licensed by the Consumer and Business Department. So if you think it's a privilege to be able to go through the hoops and rules and regulations and send in a check for $150 every 2 years for nothing, it's not a privilege. And it has nothing to do with my tax collection or my tax paying. I pay my taxes, quite frankly. And I don't need to have some bureaucrat in a licensing board overseeing my collection or payment of taxes. I pay my taxes. And if I don't, it's called a white-collar crime, and I can also be prosecuted on it. And this is just another level of bureaucracy I think we, quite frankly, don't need. Thank you.
Senator Hannon sometimes sugarcoats his feelings on bills. We've asked him to just really let us know.
Senator Deckard, never have to wonder where I'm at with Senator Hannon. I think I always know. Thank you.
Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I have no question about the proponents' motives, and that's to get revenue and to make sure that people comply with the tax code. I do have a concern about the prospective or retrospective issue. Sometimes the relatively minor issue with the Department of Revenue will get you 100% penalty. And sometimes those things take years to resolve. I mean, people have filings and back and forth and back and forth, and then there's questions and just eventually things get resolved, but sometimes they take quite a bit of time. And I would dare say that every one of the members of the committee could help constituents noodle through some of that stuff with the Department of Revenue. But this bill says has been subject to. And I guess that means has ever been subject to. So does that mean if somebody had a 100% penalty in a filing 3 or 4 years ago and paid it, they couldn't get a license?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, basically it means that if they basically have been convicted of falsely and willfully and continually failing to file and pay their income tax returns, that the department would in fact respond to the request for that information by the licensing board.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the way I look at the bill, I understand the idea of attesting compliance, because that seems to me current and prospective. But if I have been subject to 100% penalty, which could have been years ago, 2 years ago or 5 years ago, and I resolved the issue. I see under line 11, that seems to me to be a basis for withholding the license, because I have been subject to a 100% penalty, even though I might have paid it. Might have been an oversight on my part. The dollar amount owed could be $25. They could have assessed me a 100% penalty. I would have written them a check for $50, but it would be in the record as a 100% penalty. I'm wondering if that sort of follows people around.
Mr. Chair.
Who would adjudicate that, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, to your issue, you would know whether or not you had been subject to those two penalties, because those are felonies, and those would follow your record. And that is that. So you would not, you have been subject, you may have been subject to a penalty, may have been a 100% penalty, mm-hmm. but it wasn't for falsely and willingly continuing to failure to file and to pay your tax returns, your obligations. But the 100% penalty is not that uncommon, particularly in small issues, yeah. But that is not the 100% penalty we're after.
All right, so what I need to do...
So you'd be a criminal.
That was what my high school counselor always maintained anyway. Mr. Chairman, what I need to do is go back and look at 305.265.13 and 314.400-3. And those sound like criminal statutes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, they are indeed. And again, it's just a method of trying to make certain that those folks that are in the system, that we know that we know where they're at, if they're subject to these things, you wouldn't be able to get some of those, and I have to use the word privilege again, you wouldn't be able to obtain some of the privilege licenses, because that would be precluded. Folks would be precluded if they were in fact criminals and had criminal records relative to failure to file, willfully failure to file, and to willfully falsely file tax returns. And that's the folks that we're trying to make certain that we've got the cooperation with.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much, Representative Butler. Ms. Buchanan, do you want to add anything, subtract, divide? Thank you. Appreciate your time. Anyone else on this bill? Closed public hearing on
2298?
3072. 3072, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, sir.